So I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb today. I'll talk about fish feelings, the neural basis of emotional states. And I think the story, the whole project, is motivated by my attempt, the attempt of my lab to reconcile the larval zebrafish, who is a vertebrate, a card-carrying vertebrate, with sort of higher function that's usually only attributed to humans or at least higher mammals, and that's the ability to have emotional states. It also harkens back a little bit to the age-old question whether fish can feel pain, and maybe at the end of my talk I can speak to that a little bit. So that people worry about this a lot, right? Do they feel pain or not? And what does it even mean to feel pain? And can animals have emotions? And all of these things. And the goal of today's talk and the project is to try to link sort of these higher levels of psychology with the low-level mechanistic neural basis of circuits and behavior, the topic we usually work on. The hero of the story is Caroline Wee. You see her image here. She has moved since a while ago onto Singapore to have her own lab. But all the actual experiments and the neural data I'll share with you today are originating from her work, her PhD work in my lab, which was one of the most successful, as you'll see in a moment. Also, should say that Caroline really likes cats, so cats are gonna be a red thread, a common theme throughout the talk. And here, this is not Caroline's image, but this is an image I'd like to introduce when I talk about the importance of internal states. And an internal state is something that is reflected by neural activity in the complete absence of explicit behavior. So there is sort of an old, still resilient threat in neuroscience and behavioral ecology about behaviorism, that the only thing that really counts in the end is the output of the animal, the behavioral output. This sort of harkens back to Skinner in some way, but I think Skinner is being given discredit. I think he thought much more deeply than that, that there's nothing more to say about the output of an animal than its behavior. I think he didn't really believe that either. But this image here really illustrates the fact that a lot of stuff can go on in the brains of animals, even in the absence of any behavior. So if you just think about, wait a minute, let me, can you see my cursor? Yes, the arrow here, yes. So all of these German shepherds are being trained, the police dogs, they're being trained not to respond to this cat. And we all know that a lot of stuff is happening in the brains of these dogs. They really, really wanna kill the little bitch here. And the cat also knows that you can tell by the expression in her face that she's completely immune to any attack because these are well-trained dogs. So lots of activity, lots of internal states in the absence of any behavior. So I think it's just sort of a fun illustration that also has a cat in it. And you can see the cat really enjoys it. So here are the motivational states, sort of the four Fs that govern all of the drives in most animals. Four Fs are feeding, fighting, fleeing, and mating. These are the sort of internal motivational states, which I think are related to feelings, and we will talk about almost all of them. Maybe not fighting, but these ones we will address in the context of larval zebrafish. So that's another motivation for motivational and internal states. So examples of internal states, motivational states, are hunger, stress, pain, and loneliness. And those I will address. And I'll briefly talk about first a semantic issue, whether we should call these feelings. And then I'll talk about the philosophical issue briefly before I get into the neural data, where I discuss how we know that any animal or agent or another creature has an internal motivational state, an emotion, a feeling or not. By what criteria can we decide whether a larval zebrafish has a feeling or whether it's just a reflexive automated response. So there's two issues. One is semantic, the other one is somewhat philosophical. And I'll go through those briefly. So I will talk today about loneliness in Lago Zebrafish. And I've caught a lot of grief for using the word loneliness. What people told me in order to get published and get funded and to avoid getting yelled at is I shouldn't call it loneliness because that's a term from human psychology and should not be applied to animals. I should call it an aversive internal state induced by social deprivation. Then people would be okay with that in a Lago Zebrafish. But I think that's sort of avoiding the central issue, right? I think actually an aversive internal state induced by social deprivation is something that we mean when we say loneliness. Similarly, one could argue that we shouldn't call it stress or pain in a larval zebrafish, but an aversive internal state induced by a noxious insult. And also we shouldn't call it hunger, yes, but we should call it an aversive internal state induced by caloric deprivation. And I think the point I'm trying to make here, this is sort of arbitrary and semantic. And I like terms like hunger, pain, and loneliness because they resonate with non-scientists as well. It's a useful term to talk to everyday people. And I think it captures something that is, it's almost an abbreviation for these much longer, more scientific, jargony sounding terms here. So I'm not completely dug in on using these terms in Lago Zebrafish, but I would prefer it. I think one can make a good case. Now, how do we know whether an animal has an emotional or a machine, even if you want, an internal state? How do we quantify them? How do we know it is an internal state? And these are sort of three rules I've made up on the go. And the first one, I think, is that there needs to be a control of the environmental context, of the agent, of the creature, of the animal that you're studying. So the internal state needs to be in response to something, to a change in the environment. An example would be noxious heat for stress. So if you heat the animal, then there's an internal state that's resulting in an avoidance of this. If you calorically deprive the animal, if you food deprive it, then it should induce an internal state that you can call hunger, and so on and so forth, right? So one is that the environment controls it, right? This is not something that happens spontaneously and independent of environmental influence, but it's something that happens in response to the environment. And I think it should also have some adaptive feature attached to it. So I think most of these emotional, internal motivational states have evolved for a reason, namely to make the animal more adaptive. And I think that's linked to that. I should also say that these three points that I'm putting forth here are not, I don't think they're sufficient, really. They don't capture everything. They're not complete, but they are, in my view, necessary. So I think you should have all three of these to some extent fulfilled in order to confidently claim that your animal or your agent has an internal motivational state. So one is control of the environmental context. The other one is a behavioral readout. So ultimately, the behavior of the animal needs to change as a consequence of your emotional state. You lower the threshold of escape behaviors for stress, you increase feeding for hunger. So these internal states need to ultimately result in a change in the behavioral strategies. I think that's also a requirement. Otherwise they just don't make any sense and we shouldn't be allowed to call it such. And third, and I think that's probably where I can pacify a lot of the critics, is there should be also a relation to an internal neurochemical state. So some neuromodulator like oxytocin for stress and loneliness and mating behavior and serotonin for hunger. So there needs to be some neurochemical correlate that we can link it to. So I think those are the three aspects that I will discuss in Lago Zebrafish for loneliness and hunger, and you'll be the judge whether that's good enough to be able to call it a motivational or an emotional state. So I'll start with lonely fish. I caught a lot of grief for that, for calling it lonely. How can you say that? How do you know a fish feels lonely? Do fish have feelings at all? And then there's a question about how about feeling hungry? And again, I think you can call a feeling anything that in the human language is prefaced by the word I feel, right? I feel hungry, I feel lonely, I feel pain, I feel, as long as you can say that and it makes sense in English, I think then, to me at least, that's an operational definition for feeling. So first of all, do fish feel hunger? Larva zebra fish. And that's not a trivial statement, because it might be that they're actually not hungry, they just feed reflexively. There's even some rumors that say that fish will just eat until they explode and until they die, because they don't have a motivation or drive. So that's the one of the first things we set out to test. Do fish, larval zebra fish, regulate their food uptake depending on their caloric state? And what you see here is data from an experiment that Joshua Jordi in my lab did a couple of years ago, where he just quantified food intake in larval zebra fish, and he exploited the fact that larval zebra fish are perfectly translucent and that we can color in the food, the paramecia, with a fluorescent dye. If we do that, then every time a fish eats, takes a swallow of a paramecia and one bite, then the fluorescence in his gut goes up by one quantile level here. You see the gut of a larval zebra fish swimming around and getting its gut getting brighter and brighter with every paramecia it swallows. We can do this at high throughput in a 96 well plate, and we can collect these intake, intestinal food contact curves. And what you see here, this is a fish that's been fed previously before we put it in the chamber, and the internal food content goes up slowly over 60 minutes. If it's fasted for 2 hours, it goes up slightly higher, and if it's fasted for 4 hours, it goes up much quicker. And what you can see here already is that not only does the rate of food intake go up, so they eat more quickly, they also eat a lot more. So the meal size can also be quantified. And as an additional benefit, we can even quantify the pooping here. It's sort of the digestion, call it digestion. Right? So that's nice. That tells us that fish actually feel hungry. Well, they respond as if they're hungry, if they're food deprived. And so this is sort of a behavioral strategy to measure internal state of being hungry. And here is a neuronal state measuring the, another internal state in all vertebrates. And this is related to the oxytocin cluster. Yes. You all have it, all mammals have it, zebrafish have it too. It's the oxytocin system. And you've probably heard a lot about this, about the cuddle hormone, the pregnancy hormone, the sex hormone. This is even being sold now. Oxytocin is being sold in dubious shops as a spray you can spray into people's faces and they fall in love with you. Right? Makes you just... I think a lot of that is largely nonsense, but oxytocin clearly plays a role. It's an important chemical that controls and regulates internal states in all animals. And we set out to test and measure what oxytocin activity looks like in a larval zebrafish. The advantage, again, of the larval zebrafish is that it's small, it's translucent, it is a vertebrate, so it has oxytocin neurons. Here's in the preoptic area. That you also have is a prominent cluster of oxytocin neurons, and the posterior tuberculum here is another one. And this is all in the hypothalamus. This is a cluster that we can visualize by just making a transgenic animal where GFP is expressed in all of the oxytocin neurons. So they have them. Next, what Caroline did is use a sort of a very rough way of doing calcium imaging in this particular in this oxytocin cluster, simply by doing phosphoR, right? This is something akin to immediate early genes, where calcium activity will just enhance the expression of phosphorylated ERK. It's a kinase, it's a MAP kinase, and that we can visualize with an antibody post hoc. So we can just ask how the calcium activity in the oxytocin cluster relates to internal states in the animal that we can induce by long-lasting behavioral environmental manipulations. This is, people ask, why don't you do two-photon calcium imaging, brainwide imaging, you're famous for that. Well, the problem is if you head fix, head embed a larval zebrafish such that you can do brainwide calcium imaging, you already put him into an internal state that is not normal. We're not kidding ourselves, right? We realize that by head fixing or fully embedding an animal, you're not leaving it alone, right? I mean, you will influence its internal state. And the real advantage of the phospho-ERP method is it's completely non-invasive, and you don't even need a transgenic animal, right? All you have to do is catch the animal, kill it quickly, and then the phospho-ERK, the phosphorylated ERK, will give you an integrated record of the neural activity, probably of the last 2 or 3 or 4 minutes before the animal died. So, which again has a poor temporal resolution, but at least we know we haven't interfered in any way with the animal's internal state. So that's why this is useful. It also is a very simple, straightforward, and high-throughput technology. And it has, as you can see here, single-cell resolution. So we can relate the phospho-ERK signal back to the individual neurons. And here's what Caroline found when we look specifically at calcium activity, neural activity, so integrated neural activity in the preoptic area, in particular in the largely due to oxytonergic activity when we put the animal into different internal states. And the way we did that is just using a sort of a rather crude way is we used electric shocks to put them into a bad state. Yes, everybody can relate to that. Mustard oil is a somewhat toxic, abrasive chemical that burns them in a way. So this is like an insult to a fish, and they will escape to that. So then we have noxious heat, which is subjectively a little bit less bad than mustard oil or electric shocks. We have dish taps, which are just slightly annoying. We have the optomotor response, which is just showing them moving stripes and getting them to swim along. We should think that's a neutral stimulus. And then we were looking for two positive context changes, like food and like cocaine. So we know this is a different story, but we know that fish do like cocaine. They can be conditioned. Adult fish can be conditioned to seek cocaine, and larval zebrafish will swim up reliably on a cocaine gradient. So mean brain activity measured with phospho-ERK was a lot of variance here across these this gradient of state manipulations from worst to best. But what we found in the preoptic area is that there was a very strong correlation between the negativity of the stimulus and the activity in these neuronal clusters. Right? So this would suggest, at least, that oxytocin in the preoptic area, the activity correlates with a negative manipulation of the animal, and maybe even with a negative internal state. So Caroline went on to test this further. So if oxytocin activity really codes for a negative, aversive internal state, then we wanted to know what happens if you actually stimulate this. We use, I think this is one of my very few channel rhodopsin slides here. If you drive the oxytonergic activity with channel rhodopsin, what you can see that indeed the animal will start responding with large angle tail flicks, which is an aversive response to an aversive stimulus. It's an escape response. Yes. So here's a control fish that doesn't express channel rhodopsin, and here we have a fish that is expressing channel rhodopsin only in the oxytonergic neurons, and you see that there are escape tail flicks here, but with a very long latency. So this is 5 seconds total here. So it's not that this is a sensory motor drive. It seems to be that the oxytonergic activity just modulates the probability of an escape response here. So this is a response probability, which is going up with stimulus duration here. And the response frequency is also going up, which is lacking in controls. And the latency is on the order of 2 seconds. Yes, sir. For a 2 second stimulus and for a 5 second stimulus, it is the same. So this also fulfills the third or the second requirement, that oxytocin activity, if you are in a negative internal state, then you escape more. And this is a somewhat gruesome experiment here. So Caroline could show that it is indeed the oxytocin, the agonist itself, by using a headless preparation. So you just decapitate the fish and you just leave the hindbrain here. And then you simply pipette oxytocin, the agonist itself, so you're not driving neurons, onto this preparation. And what you can see here is that after a couple of minutes, presumably when the oxytocin penetrates into the prep to the relevant receptors, it elicits these extremely strong escape swims, even in the absence of a brain. Süddeutsche Zeitung, yes. All right. And here's a movie of that. Hope you can see it. So this is a headless fish, right? It's just a hindbrain. Oxytocin has been added, and now you can see that the fish is vigorously escaping just by the delivery of oxytocin, presumably. I mean, the oxytocin neurons themselves have been removed here, and they are residing in the midbrain of the hypothalamus, but the receptors in the hindbrain and the spinal cord are still there, and they presumably are eliciting these strong swims. So that's nice. So this tells us that oxytocin seems to be a system, an ancient system, that does not really enhance feeling good and cuddly and lovingly to our conspecifics, but it seems to be just a stress-related, maybe an endorphin, something that, when activated, induces defensive responses. And we got, a lot of grief for that, because it is in contrast to the law, to the party line, right, where oxytocin is supposed to make you feel good. And my interpretation of this is that, if you read a little bit more carefully the mammalian literature on oxytocin, then you'll find that oxytocin gets released mostly during childbirth, during mating, and during nursing. And I would argue that all of these are not happy events, but these are extremely stressful events, yes, sir, and certainly for females. And that what oxytocin might do is just a protective and endorphin and a response to a stressful situation that allows you to cope more adequately with it. Yes, sir. In the larval zebrafish, this is escape. In mammals, I don't know yet, in mice, in rats, or in humans, what an adequate response is. But I think what oxytocin is, the ancient responsibility of oxytocin is really more an endorphin that gets released during stressful situations. But of course, the jury on that is still out. So lonely fish, one of the other sort of Carolines, this was almost a serendipitous off-chance discovery, is that fish raised in isolation eat less. Yes, and the way she discovered is that, she had to raise fish in isolation for generating transgenic lines, and she found that they're just skinnier than the ones raised with company. And because, as I've told you 10 or 15 minutes ago, we have this quantification of this metric, this method for quantifying intake of food, so we can actually measure quantitatively how much fish eat. And so it's a very simple experiment. Is you take one fish, you take three fish, you keep them for 2 hours, either in isolation or with company, and then you add access labeled fluorescent paramecia, and you look at the fluorescence. And what you see in a single experiment, that fish raised in a group eat twice as much as fish raised in isolation. That's interesting. So I think it also argues for an internal motivational state that is modulated by something, in this case by the absence of conspecifics. And if we vary the group size between 1, 2, 3 and 5, we can see that the higher the group density, the more the fish eat. Of course, this saturates roughly at a factor of 2. Yes. Now we wanted to know, how does a larval zebrafish know that they're in a group? And because they're very visual animals, initially we thought it's a visual stimulus. Yes. So here's a first experiment. You raise a fish in isolation, but with a glass wall in a glass cage where it's surrounded by others. This is isolated but has visual input. Or, that was the alternative theory, maybe they're not seeing the conspecifics, but they're smelling them. Right? And for that, what Caroline did is just took conditioned water from a dish where fish were swimming in a group and pipetted it back into the isolated lonely fish. And she just wanted to know how much do they eat. Yes, sir. And this was quite remarkable, right? So again, we have isolated fish in a group, they eat a lot more. If you give them visual feedback, it doesn't really change much, right? I think there's no significant increase. But if you give them the odor, the conditioned water from other fish, then they eat a lot more, and this is even stronger for the pooled experiment here. So it seems that they're not seeing the other, that there seems that they're probably, they're chemically sensing them, and we think it's a smell. They're smelling the others, they like sort of the stink of brotherhood, and that makes them happy. And if you deprive them of this smell, then they are lonely, they are sad, and as we'll see, probably oxytocin gets modulated, but not in the way that you think. It's not that oxytocin goes up when there is conspecifics around, it's that oxytocin activity is being suppressed, because remember, in larval zebrafish, oxytocin is not a feel-good hormone, it's a stress hormone. So, one other behavior that we needed to get as a readout for loneliness. So one is they eat less. Another one, lonely fish seem to be more sensitive, more touchy, more jumpy in response to a noxious stimulus. And one way to deliver a noxious stimulus, which is not that easy, right? Quantifiably deliver a noxious stimulus. What Caroline did is not use shocks or heat or pain. She made use of the fact that larval zebrafish also have a TRPA1 channel, which is it's a vertebrate mammalian human pain sensor. Yes, it's on the surface of your periphery. If that gets activated, then you feel pain. And there is an agonist called Optobin, and you can cage it. You can use caged Optobin. And if you now uncage Optobin, which drives the TRPA1 channel, then you can, in a very quantified manner, you can inflict pain. And what you see is that if you take isolated fish, yes, sir, you shock them, you hurt them just a little bit, this is not very much, then they respond a lot, whereas fish who've been pre-exposed to a conspecific odor, who've been raised, so to speak, in a group, respond much less. And here's an example of that. Right? This is the tail angle and the swim velocity of the fish. So we can quantify in a way that fish who are in the presence of conspecifics are less sensitive to noxious stimuli, which again is something that of course is related to or allows us to hypothesize about oxytocin activity. And this is now when we measure oxytocin activity in social isolation. So here's the experiment. This is a neural recording, again using phosphor ERK, because we have wanted the fish to swim around freely in the presence of conspecifics or in isolation. And then we mapped oxytocin activity in the preoptic area here, and also in the posterior tuberculum. And what you can see, you remember the scaling of aversiveness that I showed you previously. This is electric shock. This is electric shock here. This is mustard oil. This is noxious heat. These are all, I think, card-carrying aversive stimuli. This is dish taps, which are slightly annoying. And here we have the increased activity due to social isolation. And in a way, this allows us to quantify already how bad it is for a larval zebrafish to be lonely or to be isolated. It's about between noxious heat and mustard oil, right? Roughly here. So if you want to know how bad it is to feel lonely for a larval zebrafish, at least we can use these semi-quantitative P-ERK activity to gauge the feeling of the negative internal state, which I think is quite remarkable, that this neuronal readout already gives us a handle on a quantitative, semi-quantitative handle on the internal state. And here we have the oxytocin activity now quantified on a cell-by-cell basis. We have electric shocks in mustard oil, which drive a lot of neurons to become active in the oxytocin clusters, both the preoptic area and the posterior tubercle. We have heat, which is slightly less, taps, which is a lot less. And here we have isolated fish, and you can just see the number of newly activated neurons, certainly more than taps and akin to heat. And with odor, isolated with odor, this activity is remarkably reduced. Right? So odor indeed, but not visual information, can reduce this activity. Now, that's sort of the story on why we believe that oxytocin really is a central node for measuring any kind of, or representing any kind of negative internal state. In terms of loneliness, the question still stands, are they really smelling it? Yes. Are they smelling the conspecifics, or are they sensing them by some other way? And for that, Caroline went and started doing proper calcium imaging now in the olfactory bulb, and as you'll see later, also in the oxytocin cluster. And first of all, we convinced ourselves that, that olfactory neurons in the olfactory bulb indeed have some specific response property to a conspecific odor. Yes, sir. So this is the olfactory neuron clusters. When we cluster the neurons according to their response profiles, we find one cluster that is specific to conspecific, another cluster that is specific to adult odor. And here I should say briefly that adult odor, or the presence of adults for a zebrafish baby, is not something happy and nice. One of the biggest, most dangerous enemies of a larval zebrafish, of a zebrafish baby, are the parents. They will eat it. Yes. So adult zebrafish, as well as any other big fish in a way, is the enemy. So adult zebrafish are a predator. Yes. So there's a different neuronal cluster in the olfactory bulb that codes for adult odor. Another one codes for paramecia. And then we have one that just responds to just the presence of water. So there are specific clusters in the olfactory bulb. And then Caroline looked in the oxytocin cluster, what those neurons do in response to these different stimuli. So in yellow, we see a pooled response to conspecific odor. This is the smell that presumably that they like, and you see oxytocin activity is going down, whereas adult odor leads to an increase in oxytocin activity, which is consistent with the idea that this induces a negative internal state and induces vivid escape responses in the larval zebrafish. The theory or the hypothesis that comes about is that there is a cluster of inhibitory neurons somewhere, presumably driven by conspecific. We call it happy water, right? Conspecific water is happy water. It puts the fish at ease. So inhibitory neurons somewhere that are driven by conspecific, by happy water, then inhibit specifically the oxytocin cluster. And here you just see a quantification of the experiment, how there's a large percentage of oxytocin neurons in the preoptic area that are indeed suppressed by the delivery of happy water, by the delivery of conspecific odor. This is 40% of the neurons in the preoptic cluster are inhibited, and only 13% of the neurons are enhanced. So it is not that simple, really, right? It is somewhat more complicated. I think oxytocin neurons code for many things. They're multidimensional. There are also a few oxytocin neurons that will be driven by happy water, but the large majority is suppressed. This is almost reversed for adult odor. If you give adult odor, adult water, conditioned water, then you see a lot of 40% of the oxytocin neurons, and they're not overlapping with the ones that are being suppressed here. They're also not the same ones that are being enhanced by conspecific odor. So this is really a switchboard oxytocin that can take in a lot of environmental information and can presumably lead to a variety of modulation of output behavior here. Right, so this is the sort of summary control experiments that went one step further of testing our theory that oxytocin indeed modulates zebrafish defensive behavior. And so what Caroline did here is to perturb, so you use sort of causal neuroscience, perturb the activity in oxytocin neurons and see what kind of behavioral effects we get. So this is again getting back to the food, right? And remember, we think that if oxytocin neurons are activated, fish will not eat, presumably because the fish is now in a defensive position where his whole brain circuitry is optimized for escape and not for for eating. So the hypothesis is that oxytocin activity correlates inversely with the intake of food. So the experiment here was done by what happens if we ablate oxytocin neurons with MTC. This is a chemical that we can use combined with a transgenic to specifically kill the oxytocin neurons. And what we find, again, this is the control where there is no chemical has been added. Again, lonely fish eat less. Fish raised in who spend some time in a group eat twice as much. If we if we ablate the oxytocin neurons, then the group fish eat just as much as the isolated one. And the isolated fish will eat just as much as the group fish, right? So what this argues is that it is indeed the oxytocin activity that prevents the fish from eating. So if you ablate them, fish, even if they're isolated, will eat just as much. This is a different way of ablating the neurons with Botox. You've all heard of that. And we get the same results. Fish raised in isolation will eat just as much if we specifically ablate these oxytocin-oxytonergic neurons. A last sort of equivalent to an ablation experiment is deliver an antagonist. Here the experiments become a little bit more dirty because pharmacology is never that specific, but Caroline did it anyway, and the results at least are perfectly consistent with our hypothesis. So if you use an antagonist to oxytocin, then again, we get the same as the ablation results. If we antagonize now the oxytocin receptor, not the activity in the oxytocin neurons, we again see that isolated fish eat just fine. There might even be some room here for, I mean, if you could show that that's the same in people. So if you don't want to eat, maybe just get rid of the oxytocin activity. But I'm not sure that there's really some clinical application here. Yeah. And finally, the agonist, there's also an agonist with a long complicated name where you can drive the receptors, oxytocin receptors, and what you can see that even in a group, fish will eat much less. So all of this is consistent. I'm not saying we've proven it, but I think it really links together the activity of oxytocin, which is a conserved ancient neuromodulator that we all have, to appetite and also to generally defensive responses when the environment changes in a negative way. Right, so this brings me to the end of the first part of the talk. I have 10 more minutes on hunger, the regulation of hunger in larval zebrafish. So far, I've mostly talked about loneliness and painful stimuli. From Alex Jordan, who says, hey, Alex, later you'll have to show me how to do a double spin and then kick people in different directions. Is this aversive response driven by assessment that being alone is a more risky scenario than being in a group and hence stressful? If so, this is more like a fear response than loneliness. Right, right. I think we get into semantic issues, right? If you are feeling uncomfortable because you're lonely, then there is one aspect whence this discomfort, right? I think we think that, so the ultimate reason why fish don't want to be alone, I think, is indeed because they are more safe in a group. So I think a lot of the adaptive evolved behaviors in larval zebrafish make sure that they stay in the same place and in a group. So this makes them survive. And I think this is just an evolved drive that they have, reflexes that make them enhance the probability that they stay in a group. So, whether you want to call it fear of being attacked, if you're lonely, I think it gets into a deep philosophical and semantic debate again. So
I think we talk later, but yeah, I think there's a very important discussion to have about a sort of reflective emotional state. I am alone and I don't like that.
Yes.
As opposed to I am alone and that's in itself not a problem, but the increased risk that suggests or that signifies or indicates is aversive. So
I think that is something that is probably exclusive to humans with really higher cognitive reasoning capacities, right? Sure. That you think you're not afraid because I think if you think about it, if you're walking alone through a graveyard at night, then you would reason that you're not afraid for unspecific reasons of being alone, but because you're afraid that some burglar or murderer will jump out behind the tree and kill you. So that's sort of the reflective aspect of being afraid when you're walking alone in the dark in the woods. I would argue that this reflective aspect is a cortical phenomenon that comes much, much later in evolution and even in our psyche. I think we're first afraid and we don't even know why we're afraid, and then the cortex tells us why we are actually afraid, because there's danger out there and it all makes sense. Maybe another really good example is the fear of getting infected with COVID right now, right? I think that's also sort of a rational construct of our cortex, much, much more than an internal state of being afraid. Or maybe something that is less provocative is the widespread fear of New England people of sharks now. Yes, because one person or two people got attacked, one person got killed by a shark last year, and now everybody is dead afraid of sharks. I would argue this is not, it has nothing to do with the rational fear of getting attacked by a large fish. It's a visceral response of our body that the cortex then later for us makes sense. I think for a larval zebrafish, it probably, or for any other animal than a human, and maybe even for humans themselves, it doesn't even make all that much sense to distinguish between the two. Like the difference between afraid because I'm lonely and I might get attacked versus the I'm just afraid because I don't like being lonely. Right? That's the difference you're talking about, right, Alex?
Yeah, and I think it has a lot to do with social transmission of information and
sure.
gauging a risk or a landscape of fear based on the absence, presence, behavior responses of other individuals or either other sources of information. But yeah, we're getting way off topic. So Okay. Let's chat about it later.
Let's talk about eating. Yeah. 5 more minutes. I'll try to be quick here. It's eating and hunger. Here, cats again. So I think I've made the point that the... I'll try to keep this brief, but I think it's about the relationship between serotonin and hunger. And the brief version of the story is that until quite recently, there's been very conflicting results in the literature, mostly derived from experiments in mice, but also in people, about how serotonin relates to hunger. And the some of the literature will tell you that when serotonin goes up, hunger goes down. You find a lot of that. And another part of the literature will tell you that serotonin correlates positively with hunger. So the more serotonin activity you have, the more hungry you are. And this really has not been resolved, and Caroline resolved it, and I'll tell you that story. What's the difference between, how serotonin can, when it goes up, how increased serotonin activity can both increase you being hungry or also decrease your feeling of hunger. And again, we are back to the hypothalamus. That's also the home of the oxytocin neurons. And it is really the hub, the center of all neuromodulatory activity, I think in all vertebrates, really. So there's lots and lots of neuromodulatory substances, which are all conserved. I mean, this is nice about this whole story that zebrafish and mammals and humans really using the same hardware, neuronal hardware, to modulate activity in the rest of the brain. It is highly conserved. I've said this already. Here is the hypothalamus in larval zebrafish, where it is rather large compared to what you find in mammals. And there's the caudal hypothalamus here, medial lateral hypothalamus, and the lateral hypothalamus. Maybe just remember the lateral and the caudal one. This is going to be important because here. And again, this is about appetite, serotonin in this case. And here are all the people who were involved. And again, it is about an internal state, is how hungry do you feel? And behavior we are looking at is in you have external food cues, and then you either get consumptive behavior if you're in a low caloric state. So this is a cat that's being hungry, it will eat the mouse. And here's a cat. This is not a hungry cat, this is sort of a satiated cat, right? And it's sort of doing a half-assed job at trying to get at this. So what is the difference in internal state between those two cats? One that is just looking, the other one is. And in a nutshell, what Caroline found is, of course, not of course, but remarkably, also in a larval zebrafish, it is linked to serotonergic activity in the caudal hypothalamus. And here, this is using phosphor, but also calcium imaging, are the activity curves that Caroline found. So first, if you fast the fish, then serotonergic activity in the caudal hypothalamus is going up. This is consistent with half of the party line. Yes. Half of the people think that, of course, more serotonin, the more hungry you are. And so if you starve the animals, serotonergic activity is going up. And in the lateral part, the green part, these contain of the hypothalamus, lateral does not contain serotonergic neurons, but glutamatergic neurons. And there we see that activity is going down. So they seem to be anti-correlated. So far, I'll just present these as findings, as data. Now, here was a remarkable finding. The moment you present food, you do not actually start feeding them. They're not eating, they're just seeing the food, yes, sir? The instance they're exposed to food cues, serotonergic activity drops way below baseline levels. Yes. So there's something about the sensory input of the cue, of the food cue, that seems to block serotonergic activity entirely. And this is sort of consistent with our idea that these two neuronal groups are mutually inhibitory, so they inhibit each other. This will relieve inhibition from the glutamatergic neurons, and they will go up now. And what we hypothesize is the strong drive in glutamatergic neurons will actually drive for voracious feeding. But now see what happens. When the animal is now eating and presumably getting less and less hungry, serotonergic activity is increasing again. And you see how this is sort of beautiful, right? It tells you that when the animal is getting hungry and hungry in the absence of food, it correlates with serotonergic activity. Then when it's exposed to food, so in the presence of food, right, serotonin correlates with satiety. And I think that is interesting for two reasons. One, it sort of resolves almost the issue that serotonin can correlate both with being hungry and with being satiated. So there's a positive correlation here and here. If you don't look at the switch, you will never notice, right? You see a positive correlation between serotonin activity and being satiated. The more you eat, the higher the activity. Here, if you don't know the baseline levels, right? Here you see that the more hungry you get, the higher the serotonergic activity is. But even more importantly, I think this actually reflects a different internal state. Yeah. Being hungry in the absence of food is very, very different internally than being hungry in the presence of food. Being hungry in the presence of food, I would argue, is a positive internal state. It's also the adaptive behaviors when you're in the presence of food is very, very different than the adaptive behavior when you're hungry in the absence of food. So, hungry in the absence of food means you need to hunt. So, hungry in the presence of food means you need to forage, you need to graze, you need to eat. So what I think what serotonin is doing is it's in the absence of food, it will drive exploratory behavior. It drives exploration. In the presence of food, serotonergic activity will suppress. Well, so if there's no more drive for exploratory behavior, you suppress exploratory behavior and you enhance now exploitation behavior. And all of you who have children, I think, have encountered this really annoying problem that if they just don't want to eat this. Even if they might be hungry, right? So certainly, I think this one, if you're in this state here, in the hungry, in the absence of food, you don't eat. Yes? You're suppressing eating behavior. You look for exploratory behavior. Yeah? The moment you get exposed, then this activity should get suppressed. But if it's not, if this circuit is not yet active, what you will do is you will keep hunting. You will keep exploring, you will keep looking around, and you will not stop and shut the fuck up and eat. This, I think, also happens sometimes in predators. If a predator is in hunting activity, it might remain there. It gets bloodthirsty, it will just keep killing and keep hunting and will not exploiting and eating. And this can be very, very maladaptive because if you're a tiger or another hunter and you've made your kill, and the food is now, you get food cues, but you keep hunting, then your food source will probably get stolen and removed by other predators. So I think the switch from exploratory, from hunting activity to exploitatory grazing activity is absolutely essential. It's an adaptive thing for any predator. So I think cows won't have this, tigers will. And the question is, why do we believe that larval zebrafish are rather tigers than cows? And I think the remarkable thing about larval zebrafish is they can switch. They can switch between a defensive exploratory mode where they're just running away from predators, but then they can actually switch into predatory mode where they converge their eyes, start hunting, and start looking for food. And I think this is exactly what's happening, is this this remarkable switch from exploration to exploitation. And again, we can use a variety of, in this case, it is optogenetic perturbations, where we can activate the serotonergic neurons now, because we have a molecular genetic handle on the serotonergic neurons. And what is shown here is again that the feeding response in fish that express the REACHER, this is a channel rhodopsin derivative. There's another one who wants to get admitted. We can increase the food consumption if we activate serotonergic activity 30 minutes before feeding. Yes, sir. However, during feeding, yes, if we activate serotonergic activity during feeding, it actually reduces the food intake. Yes, sir. And that, I think, sort of is a suggestive. It's no proof. It's a suggestive bit of information that argues that we might be on the right track here. If we ablate serotonergic neurons altogether, then the idea would be that we are now constantly sitting in this state down here, where the animal will not feel hungry, but whenever it is getting exposed to food, it will be compelled to eat a lot. And that's exactly what we find. Yes, sir. So if we ablate these neurons, these serotonergic neurons, either with laser ablations or with MTC controls, then they will eat just a lot more. Even fed fish will keep eating, and food-deprived fish will eat a lot more. And I think with that, I'll end. I think this is just a very appealing and intriguing example of how a group of neurons, in this case, serotonergic neurons, not oxytocin as shown previously, regulate hunger but not in a simple dial up or dial down way. They regulate the feeling of hunger in a way that depends on the presence or absence of food cues. So meaning in the absence of food, serotonin makes you feel hungry, yes, and makes you look for food. In the presence of food, right, it stops the exploratory behavior and allows the rest of the system to engage in feeding behavior here. Right? It releases here the ability to feed, and the hunger state then will drive serotonergic neurons up, probably some glucose metabolism effect, such that this release of the feeding state gets more and more relaxed until the animal just doesn't care anymore. Satiety means you just don't feel like eating. And so that's sort of the cartoon that Caroline drew. And I think with that, yes, I summarize here again, hunger with and without food are different brain states that may drive distinct behaviors. Yes, hunger with no food is exploration. It suppresses actually consumption and feeding. And hunger in the presence of food cues will use to consumptive behaviors. With that, I'll stop. I'll thank you all for your attention. And most of all, I want to thank Caroline for her contributions. I mean, she did all the work. And I'll be happy to take questions.
So we have a question from Hannah Williams. Sorry if confusing. If lonely and physical pain, fear, both increase oxytocin, is there an interactive effect? E.g., is the negative feeling of loneliness decreased if being social exposes you to the physical pain others may experience?
Oh, yes, that's an excellent question, Hannah. Not in larval zebrafish. I don't know. That's actually something we haven't tested yet. There is, so if you have a fish watch another fish being obviously in pain, I don't think they will care much. But there is one aspect.
Well, unless they're damaged. Unless they're
no, exactly. So there is one interesting aspect. So is Carl von Frisch, the guy who maybe you know from the honeybee experiments, remarkable stuff, also has discovered that fish, when they get attacked, injured, will release a substance called Schreckstoff that the mostly German-speaking audience here will understand instantly. So they release
this. It translates the scary stuff.
Scary stuff.
Which we find in English, it's even funnier.
So then fish will freak out and show, if you want, empathy. And a really philosophical, interesting question is, does this count, right? If fish get scared because other fish get injured, but it is sort of just in response to a olfactory cue that makes them scared, then I think it almost gets back to Alex Jordan's question previously, right? If I'm afraid, because I know that if I'm lonely, I might get attacked more, and that's why I'm afraid, does this count more? Is this more important than if I'm just afraid because it smells like being afraid here, or because it's dark, or because there's nobody around me? Yes, I think this ultimate feeling that you all know, right, is sort of this unspecific sense of being afraid. I think that is something that larval zebrafish have. If in this case they don't smell happy water, but if they smell scary stuff, if they smell Schreckstoff, yes, they certainly, and we haven't done this yet because larvae don't respond all that well to Schreckstoff. It's more like juveniles and adults. But one really good experiment would be to expose larvae to Schreckstoff, to scary stuff, and see whether oxytocin activity would go up. And I think that it almost fulfills Hannah's requirements that they are socially exposed to the suffering of others.
Do you think that such dysregulated serotonin actions you described contributes to the rise in obesity or metabolic disease in humans? Why do you think animals get stuck in the, quote, bloodlust?
They're two different, they're both really good questions, right? Yes, I think so. I think that the... what we show in the zebrafish, or at least we can hypothesize, that the sudden decrease in serotonergic activity releases, opens a gate for reflexive consumptive behavior. So if you see food and you're not controlled by the serotonergic activity, you will just keep eating. In a healthy larval zebrafish, what will happen is that the increase in caloric intake will drive up the serotonergic activity until it suppresses again this consumptive drive. And this might very well happen in humans as well, right? If this gate of leaving this drive to eat, this reflexive response to food cues, if that just stays open and doesn't get closed again, you will just keep eating as long as there's food, right? And I think in also in humans, serotonin might actually play a role like that. And there is a lot of evidence. The problem with humans is that serotonin doesn't just act in the caudal hypothalamus. You have serotonin everywhere in the brain, and it's doing everywhere really important, interesting stuff. So interfering with serotonin activity or with serotonin receptors is really thorny. It's a complicated issue. You can't just give somebody a pill that reduces serotonin activity and hope that they will stop eating, because it will fuck up a lot of other neuromodulatory circuits, feedback circuits in the brain. The blood loss in animals, I think that's exactly what is happening. Is in this case, so I would say that the hunting and the killing is part, even in humans, is this drive to hunt, the thrill of the hunt, has nothing to do with appetitive, with consumptive behavior. It's an independent drive for gathering, for collecting, for hunting, getting access to food. And I think that is driven by very high serotonergic activity. So in larva zebrafish, certainly. This might also be true in ferrets, mostly in predatory animals. And if that switch doesn't happen, if the gain, the power of the food cues, right, is not strong enough to make the switch, to shut off the serotonin, you will just stay in this killing frenzy. And I think that's what happens if you release a fox or a weasel into a hen house. Very good. Okay. Stephanie.
Do you want to read the text?
Great talk. You said oxytocin can be seen as a type of endorphin released to help cope with childbirth, mating, and breastfeeding. Yes. If it is a type of endorphin, then shouldn't oxytocin feel good? Yeah, well, sure, yes. It should feel good, yes. I follow that oxytocin is released during aversive events in the zebrafish, but do you think that the oxytocin makes them feel good too, like an opioid? Yeah, or is it simply an internal cue for the fish that something aversive is happening? Well, I think we are getting, again, this is the core, right? This is the philosophical issue of how do you know that something feels good, right? I mean, you might even, if you want a real brain teaser, is think about a computer, a machine like the Roomba or your Siri, right? When are they happy? When do they feel good? So, in a nutshell, I think actually, yes, if oxytocin gets released, it makes you feel good. I think that is true. I think that's what you see. That's for all other endorphins, right? But the reason why it feels good, right, for humans is because it serves to attenuate a aversive negative stimulus. It allows you to ignore the pain. And maybe endorphins, what we think feeling good is ultimately, is just the removal of pain. And again, this is a philosophical debate, right? If you bang your head against the wall, right, does it really feel good if you stop? Yeah? Is that what you mean by feeling good? Because I think that's really what it is for oxytocin, right? Is that suddenly you can cope with the pain. And arguably, it feels good, right? If the pain goes away. But that's not really probably what you mean or what we mean. And I think that's where it just gets really thorny and sketchy, right? It's because we are entering a realm of human psychology and philosophy rather than sticking to sort of behavioral readouts and adaptive, evolutionarily controlled strategies that an animal develops. I think that's what makes this difficult. So I think, yes, it probably feels good to a fish if oxytocin gets released, the same way that it feels good to you when you suddenly stop hurting you. For the fish, the aversive is happening. Just as a note, while zebrafish may not respond to aversive observed scenarios in social partner, Alex Jordan. Just as a note, while zebrafish may not respond to aversive observed scenarios in social partners, cichlids do show. Oh yeah, no, I know. There's many, especially adult. I see also adult zebrafish have a lot of these social interactions. Female genomic response to mate information. No, very good. Thank you, Alex. From Stephanie to everyone, thanks. I see your point. I'll bang my head against the wall and I think, what? Very good, yes.